Good morning. Hello, good morning, and thank you all for coming to the Center for Strategic and International Studies for this excellent book launch we have for Ben Heineman and his new book. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm our Vice President for External Relations here at the Center. It's a real honor, and I'm not going to take up too much time telling you about all the great things CSIS is doing because we've got a fantastic program. I'm going to introduce my colleague, Nancy Boswell from Transparency International, who's co-hosting this event with us, and then we're going to get right to the program. But thank you all for coming. This event, we will have a video posted on our website of this event later today, so for those of your friends and colleagues who couldn't come, they'll be able to see it at csis.org. And with that, I'll turn to my colleague, Nancy Boswell.
Thank you, Andrew, and welcome, everyone. On behalf of Transparency International USA, I'd just like to say when Andy and I talked about introducing Ben, we agreed he needs no introduction. Ben is widely known and widely respected in the private sector, but also in the public and nonprofit sectors for his intellect, his strategic insights, and an unwavering commitment to integrity. This book is really a welcome contribution. It reflects that commitment and provides an urgently needed roadmap and an inspiration for those of us working on the challenging issue of confronting corruption. We've always appreciated Ben's engagement on our board, his support for our mission, and today we welcome this must-read book. It will really make an important contribution to our efforts and to fostering integrity. So with that, let me turn the mic over to you, Ben. Thanks very much to all of you.
Thanks, Nancy. First, thanks to David Wessel and Dan Mudd for coming and joining me today. We're going to try to split the time equally, maybe go for 30 minutes, 10 minutes each, to talk, then comment on each other, and then have 20 minutes for Q&A and literally stop in 1 hour. The purpose of the book was really to make the argument that high performance with high integrity are the twin goals of the modern corporation and indeed of modern capitalism. Let me define what I mean by integrity. Obviously, robust adherence to the spirit and letter of the rules, the formal rules, financial and legal. The second element are global ethical standards that the company commits to on behalf of all its employees that have the effect of the formal rules. And thirdly, and maybe most importantly, are the values that it wants its employees to exemplify. And those values are honesty, candor, fairness, reliability, and trustworthiness. No organization, no good organization can operate unless its employees has those values. Otherwise, you've got turf fighting, backbiting, an inability to work well in teams. Spending time on your own personal agendas, not on the organization's agenda. So critically important. In a nutshell, the book basically argues why these two goals are important, basically to avoid catastrophic effects, but also because I strongly believe that high performance with high integrity has affirmative benefits in the company, in the marketplace, and in the global society. And to put it one word to it, they create trust. Capitalism and corporations, in the end of the day, really do depend on trust, trust in their products, but trust also in what kind of character they have. And character, in my view, is another word for integrity. The book then talks about sort of eight principles that I think apply to organizations large or small, domestic or global, so a few practices underneath, and then applies them to some of the difficult issues, emerging markets, public policy, crisis management, acquisitions, reputation. The point of the book was to write for business leaders. There's lots of stuff in this area for specialists. I don't think there's much written for business leaders. We've got 1,000 books on high performance if you go to the bookstores. I sort of think they're diet books, you know, how to make $10 billion and lose 10 pounds. And then you've got a lot of books as well on sort of integrity, far fewer, but often written from the point of view of CSR folks or from ethicists who haven't been inside of organizations. So I was trying to write from the perspective of someone who'd lived inside the belly of the beast for 18 years and how we'd struggled with these problems. I also want to say at the outset that I'm very humble in writing this book. I never say, and obviously it's based heavily on my experience at GE, I never say we did it right. I only say that we tried. And that leads me really to what I want to do today very, very briefly is talk about four debates that the book also addresses, corporate governance debate being the first one. I believe deeply that we've spent way too much time on directors since Enron and not nearly enough time on CEOs. There are three dimensions of governance, shareholders, company, board management, management, and really all the employees who they have to deal with. We spend far too little time understanding how to fuse performance with integrity inside the company. Only the CEO can do it. Only the CEO can do it. That's basically my argument with corporate governance debate, because only the CEO can create the culture that is so important to have this happen. Create the culture by leadership, stating the aspirations, talking about how the world is changing, stating the values. But in the business literature, there's leadership and there's management. Management is dealing with complexity, routines, systems, processes, resources, people, accountability. And you have to have both. You've got to drive leadership and management, and only the CEO can make this happen inside a company. The board meeting 8 times a year cannot do it. So issue number one is governance. Strongly believe that we've got to focus much more on the affirmative role of the CEO in fusing these two broad goals in the way I've discussed. Related to that is a board role, and that's pay for performance with integrity. There's a huge debate, as all of you know who follow business, about how we make sure that we compensate CEOs for real performance, not outsized pay packages that are serendipitous, don't necessarily have anything to do with how they perform. I think we need to add something else to that equation, and there's a lot of debate about how that works. But we need to pay for performance with integrity. If we really want to fuse performance with integrity, we have to basically compensate it. I think you can measure integrity. There are 5 elements, for example. You can see if the CEO and all the business leaders are actually have adopted the right principles, whether they've adopted the right practices, what kind of culture they've created. You can do surveys, 360s. There are a lot of ways of determining corporate culture. You can compare to peer companies, and you can have annual goals and objectives. Those are 5 relatively clear, distinct elements that you can measure and make part of compensation packages. Related to that, I think, is we have to change the CEO spec a little bit. Sure, you look to see if a CEO has high integrity, but you really have to see if they've got the skill, experience, commitment, intensity to do this fundamental task of fusing high performance with high integrity. So we need to change the spec, and we need to change the pay in terms of CEO, and that has implications across the company, because then you change your management development process for people under the CEO from year 30 onward, and you have the same kind of compensation system, pay for performance with integrity, not just for the CEO, but for business leaders. So that's the second debate. The third debate is global ethics. What do you do beyond what the law demands? I always used to say I was not the senior vice president for moral philosophy at GE. You know, I was not a Hegelian, I was not a Lockean, I was not a Rawlsian. You know, I was just a poor guy who had to deal with stuff every day and deal with the tough CEO on occasion. So how did it work? Well, I think basically you need to have a process, first of all. You need to understand what are stakeholders asking for, and of all those issues, and there are literally thousands of them, which ones are of importance to you? And they can be of importance to you for a lot of different reasons. And that's one of the things I think that people don't understand as well. There's no single reason why you do these things. There are multiple reasons why you may choose to go beyond what the law requires and what your actions are. Take bribery. When we started, we just decided there was going to be no bribery, public or private, anywhere in the world, even though the law didn't require no private bribes. It didn't require basically no use of facilitating payments, and we tried very hard not to use them, although we may have had to on occasion. But that was a decision made for a lot of reasons. The main reason was if you want those values that I discussed in the employees, it totally corrupts the organization to bribe and to hide it and keep it secret. So I always would say to the CEO and the other business leaders, guys, look, there are a lot of reasons why we shouldn't do it. There's legal risk, there's reputational risk, it hurts the developing world, all sorts of stuff. But the main reason is it hurts our company. It's a cancer inside the company. Another example of a sort of global standards would be our standards for global sourcing. That was partly because we didn't want where we would go and look at health and safety, living conditions, wages, those kinds of things. And we would do it partly because we didn't want supply interrupted, because even though there was episodic enforcement in these markets, they could still come and stop your supplier from working. You didn't want that. Secondly, we had to answer the critics of globalization. At least at GE, we were an iconic company. An awful lot of the globalization debate is about labor markets. You don't want to be exporting bad practices that you wouldn't do in the U.S. So we wanted to have our suppliers, even though they were not part of us, we wanted our suppliers to have good practices. So there again, a combination of sort of policy arguments, prudential arguments, that led us to what we called ethical sourcing. So I think when you think about global ethics, you really need to think very much in the context of the issue, a variety of reasons, and it is a cost-benefit analysis. People don't like to hear me say that, but it's a cost-benefit analysis. It's just that you define things a little differently. The investment is the cost. It's a cost that turns out to be an investment in something. And the return is going to be a benefit that may be hard to put a numeric value on. But judgment's going to tell you it makes sense. It made sense for us to do ethical sourcing. We didn't really worry too much about the additional cost. We had to be at these suppliers anyway to look at them. We didn't do a discounted rate of return. We just concluded as a matter of judgment that it was the right thing to do. So when you do this cost-benefit analysis, you have to think of the cost as investment, and you have to think of the benefit as something that may be more accessible by judgment than by numbers. Last debate, corporate citizenship, and then I'm going to stop. Corporate citizenship, in my view, is a better way to think about corporate social responsibility. The real question is, what's the role of business in society? Three pillars. Strong economic performance, got to be the first, because there are tremendous benefits to all the stakeholders from strong, durable economic performance. GE is the only company to be in the Dow Jones for its whole history. Secondly, obviously, robust adherence to the law, as I mentioned. And third are these sort of global standards that go beyond what the law requires. Sometimes you will do it because it makes sense for you and you will take voluntary action. One of the things I try to argue in the book, and that business leaders don't like to think about, is there's a public policy dimension of this as well. There should be times when you really want to advance a social good because it's both good for the corporation and good for society. An example, again, would be in the bribery area, where in the late 80s, the Reagan administration, the Bush administration were talking about basically weakening the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act so American companies could compete. And a number of American multinationals got together and said, no, we shouldn't level down, we should level up. We should make the OECD countries, the developed countries, basically have laws that prevent bribery of their domestic corporations in foreign contexts. So that was a good example of where it was important to take a public policy position. We shouldn't be just knee-jerk against regulation. Many times regulation serves a social good and levels the playing field. It makes everybody pay a cost that's necessary for the good of society. I'm going to stop. But that's the sort of the little essence of the book and sort of three or four of the most important controversies that it tries to address. Dan?
Okay. Thank you, and thank you for having me. I had the pleasure of working at GE for about a decade before going to Fannie Mae. I left the Marine Corps to go to GE, and I left GE to go to Fannie Mae. And now, after years of therapy, I'm able to sit up straight and take nourishment most days. So I'm very appreciative, Ben, that you invited me. I got called in late 2004 in the middle of the night early in the morning and asked whether I would be willing to take over on an interim basis a company that had no financials, no external auditor, no internal auditor, no CFO. And on down the line, and the question was, well, gee, what do you want me to do with none of that? And the answer was, well, I guess I'll start hacking away and try to put it together. And that's what we've been doing ever since then. The proximate cause of all my problems back then was accounting, but I quickly concluded, actually slowly concluded, after spending a couple of $1 billion getting the accounts back in order and a couple of years at Fannie Mae and a couple of thousand employees and contractors to do that, that the odds were very strong that at least on my watch, for better or worse, we would not have another accounting problem. But I was quite sure that we would have another problem of some kind. And that's just the point that I thought to augment what Ben said that would be helpful to hear, that we decided that the way to prevent another problem of that magnitude, you could put a belt and suspenders on almost everything you do inside the company, whether it's accounting or whether it's HR or whether it's pricing or whether it's marketing or whether it's the back office, and you still probably wouldn't be smart enough to outsmart every single person who might do the wrong thing in the organization. And therefore, we concluded that ultimately the way to really avoid another, the way to minimize the chances of another big fiasco was with culture. And I think culture, my interpretation of a lot of what Ben has written in the book goes to culture, because I know in a large organization with a lot of complex problems and a large number of people, in our case, spread around the company, in GE's case, spread around the world, the thing that nips problems in the bud is a culture where everybody feels like they can raise their hand and get their issue addressed and get their concerns dealt with.
Over time, I think when companies have those lapses, there are two ways that they get dealt with. And Ben talked about management and leadership. The note that I made here was that I really think there are formal processes, and that's been a lot of the focus of the corporate governance community lately, but there are also informal processes. And to some extent, the formal processes have to do with management, and the informal processes have to do with leadership. Examples of formal processes, executive sessions. We have executive sessions not only after every board meeting, we also have them after every committee meeting. Example of formal processes, we have reporting lines from our head of ethics, our head of compliance, our chief risk officer, our head of audit, directly to the board, not to me, formal processes. They have specific objectives. We have specific objectives for culture, for behavior, for the way that we do business. Code of conduct, a management pledge that's basically a pledge that figuratively our managers raise their right hand and say, here's how I'm going to treat the people that work for me, and here's how I'm going to treat the people that I work with, formal. We have an executive committee that makes most of the central decisions in the company, and it has on it the general counsel, the head of HR, the head of internal audit, as well as the head of ethics. But I think, importantly, equal to those formal processes are the informal things that you do. So walking around and making yourself as the CEO accessible to people so that they can address you wherever they're comfortable. And unfortunately, the places they turn out to be comfortable often turn out to be pretty amusing. Traditionally, the men's room, figuratively, people's offices, but literally on one family holiday, it emerged that both my wife and I had forgotten to go out and buy the turkey. So with about an hour and a half to go, I rushed up to the supermarket under deadline to buy the turkey. And as I was standing in the line with the 26-pound turkey, I didn't know how I was going to get it cooked in the hour and a half that I had available. And that's a story for a different forum. But standing in the line with the 26 and a half pounds, I think it was, turkey, somebody came up to me and said, you're Dan Mudd. I work at Fannie Mae. And I've got some ethical concerns about things going on in the company. So, you know, management by walking around involves a lot of real estate. So, I put the turkey down. And anyway, the tacos were good that night. Okay. Informal processes, I answer every email that comes into me eventually personally. I have office hours. Employees can come in and express concerns, and they certainly do. We say again and again and again and again to people, if you feel that something is going on, you have to raise your hand. It's the equivalent in the manufacturing world of you have to feel free to pull the lever that stops the assembly line. We try to answer questions. We try to encourage questions. And those folks that I talked about that had the independent, while on one hand they have a reporting line that goes in to the board of directors, they also have unfettered access to our regulator and to our compliance hotlines and all those other things. And I think the more you make those things informally possible, the better off you are. So I think ultimately creating that culture where the next time, as I say, it won't be an accounting issue that somebody raised their hand and I think we're in the wrong place, but it'll be a different issue. It'll be an HR issue, or it'll be a workplace issue, or it'll be a business practice issue. But if the culture enables people to access both the formal and the informal byways, and the mentality is it's better to raise your hand and deal with the problem when it's this big, because, you know, as we all know, most of the time the incidence of the problem is actually this big. It's the post facto reaction to the problem that causes it to spin out of control and completely divert the organization from its purposes. If you can get somebody to raise their hand when the problem is this big and solve it in an honest and open and honorable and transparent way, that really goes a long way toward preserving the health company and not having to go through the expensive and time-consuming path that I talked about. So that's why we spend a lot of time in our organization, Ben, focusing on culture. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you. I'm flattered to be invited to this thing for two reasons. One is the closest thing I've ever come to a board is being on the board of Temple Sinai in Washington, D.C., but I actually learned a lot there about the responsibility of directors to ask obnoxious questions, which, of course, journalists are well suited for. It's also when the CEO sitting at the end of the table is your rabbi, though, it does present some challenges. So it's been an interesting experience. The second thing is that, in a way, a reporter is a strange person to ask to do this, since we have the great luxury of sitting in judgment of everybody else, of having less regulation and licensing than almost any profession in the United States. I think I thank God every day for the First Amendment, which means I didn't have to take any bar exam, and there's no board of hairdresser examiners making sure that I am capable of doing what I do every day or doing it safely. But on the other hand, we have learned our own hard way about the added responsibilities that puts on a newspaper to find its own way to police its ethics and do the right thing, because you can't blame your regulator, and most of the time you win the lawsuit on libel. So the only thing that separates out the reputation, the newspapers with good reputations and the one with poor reputations, is how well you handle that. And we like to tell ourselves that the newspapers with more credibility are more successful, and we worry every day that that's not true, that the American public may choose to read more interesting publications that are less ethical and less credible, and we worry about that a lot in the mainstream press, and I'm happy to talk about that later. It's not really the subject of this thing. I wanted to make a couple of responses to Mr. Heinemann's book, first to compliment him for writing a book short enough for the people who are discussing it to read, which is no small accomplishment if you go to the bookstore. Secondly, to emphasize a point he made, which, interesting, I had written down before he said it, which was this sometimes counterintuitive notion that trust is a fundamental building block of modern capitalism. I think if you stop and think about this, your initial reaction might be, well, you know, capitalism is this big anonymous thing where General Electric does business with Fannie Mae, which does business with Dow Jones or News Corp, and it's all a bunch of anonymous stuff, and it's all done impersonally with automated underwriting systems and legal documents that are hundreds of pages long to imagine any eventuality, so that there's no trust involved. But I think actually the opposite is true, that in some primitive economy where you actually know everybody you buy and sell from, where if your neighbor sells you eggs that are rotten and you're going to have to see him the next day, it's all sort of on the table. You don't need to trust him because everything's on the surface and it's very personal. It's your neighbor you're buying from. Whereas we every day conduct anonymous transactions, some online, some at a cash register, some by telephone, and we sort of trust that the people on the other side will do what they say they're going to do. And we have these systems for sort of matching the paperwork later, or supposedly these legal documents that are supposed to work out things. But, you know, the disputes that end up in litigation are not the successes. It's the number of disputes in American business that get worked out without litigation, because maybe the clause wasn't quite written for this eventuality, but people of goodwill managed to find a compromise that I think is what makes the system work. If we had to litigate every business dispute, the economy would grind to a halt. I know Dan probably thinks we do litigate every business dispute, and there's some evidence on his side. Secondly, I'm fascinated by the CEO board distinction that Mr. Heinemann has made. I'm mostly sympathetic to it. We know that in the end, somebody has to be responsible. And we know, if you cover public policy, that the decision that John F. Kennedy made in the Cuban Missile Crisis was not one of process. At some point, his judgment came to play, and he stood up to the military, and we didn't have World War III. And at the Federal Reserve today, in the end, it's Ben Bernanke has to make a decision about what's the best thing to do, and most of the other people in the Federal Reserve will follow him. So despite the fact that we're a big, complex society, and we like to think of ourselves as a government of laws, not men, we rely to an extraordinary extent on the judgment of the people we choose to be our leaders. I'm reminded of a conversation I once had with Paul O'Neill when he was at the Treasury, and I was writing some about the corporate scandals. And as you know, if you go talk to someone who's the Treasury Secretary and you want to talk about the Treasury or the President, you get a lot of, in Paul O'Neill's case, you don't get much caution, but you generally get a lot of caution. But when you ask them to tell war stories about their last lives, they get very interesting. And Paul O'Neill was discussing the corporate scandals and described a situation where he had someone come to his office when he was CEO of Alcoa to sell him a tax shelter, a corporate tax shelter, that was right on the line. You know, the lawyers and the accountants would have said it was okay, but it really smelled. And he told me, he threw the guy out of the office, and he did it very loudly because he wanted all the staff to know that he was trying to send a signal that we're just not going to go play this close to the line. I don't want anybody ever to send me another guy like this, even if it would save Al Cohen money. And I know from my own career as a journalist that those moments where somebody does something like that, where an editor tells you, I think you're probably right, but I'm not sure enough to run the story, so we're not going to run the story, those are the ones that stick with you. I think we can't let the boards off the hook, though. And I had a conversation with a bunch of businessmen after the Enron scandals where they were making excuses for what the Enron board had done, and they were testifying to the wisdom and integrity of the individuals who had been on the Enron board. And finally, I got sort of impatient, and I said, look, these guys approved a waiver of the ethics policy so the CFO could be on both sides of the transaction, on his own interest and on that of the corporation. And if that's what a board does, then what's the point of having boards of directors at all? Right? And I think that there's some, it's worth thinking about. If the boards of directors cannot do what Ben Hindman thinks they ought to do, basically pick an ethical CEO and set up processes that can prevent most of the big mistakes, then there's a question of why do we have this form of capitalism at all? Let's just have some other way of picking our corporate leaders. I think that it's, if it were always in the interest of every organization to be ethical, there would be fewer unethical businesses out there. The real questions come not where it's in the long-term interest of a company to do something and it just doesn't realize it's in its long-term interest, but where there may actually be advantages to doing something that's unethical or at least on the line. And I think those are the really interesting moments. The cases where a company that really is not as big as GE and Fannie Mae and really cannot afford not to get this contract that their competitor is bribing somebody to get, or the company that's doing business with Walmart and knows that if it can't shave costs a little bit, Walmart will go to somewhere else. Those are the really interesting circumstances, the places, and they exist, but the most interesting moments are the ones where a company makes a decision to do something ethical that it's hard to argue is not going to hurt it in the short run and might hurt it in the long run. And I think that it's too easy sometimes for people to say, I think it particularly comes up in environmental things, to say, well, if you only had the right worldview, you'd see this was in your interest. Well, sometimes you have to do things that are right but are not in your interest, and I think those are the really interesting close calls to study. I think that, as both gentlemen mentioned, the real test comes not in how you set the principles, but how you respond when something goes wrong. And I think that's a lot harder than sometimes we make it seem. In newspapers where this comes up is not so much internally. I think we actually are more thoughtful than most people realize about what we do. We're more conscious about the impact that a negative or unfair story can have on our readers. And where I see us making mistakes are not where we stopped and thought about, is this right or wrong, but where because when we do, we usually make the right decision, but when we were careless and didn't think about some implication, and that's where we get into trouble. I'm sure that happens in business as well. But where we run into trouble is, what do you do when you get the call from the whistleblower? And the whistleblowers are never simple people, you know. The people who identify problems inside Boeing or inside the FDA are never these people who've led wonderfully model lives, have been totally lived, never passed a car where the line wasn't dotted, and have never, you know, cursed on the telephone. They tend to be somewhat crazy people who are conspiracy theorists, and you have to evaluate whether they're like, they have a vendetta against somebody, whether they're nuts and paranoid, or whether they're actually onto something, because, as you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody's not out to get you. And it's tough, and I don't think we always make the right call. We turn away some whistleblowers who are actually onto something. We sometimes run with whistleblowers who they are telling us the truth, but they've seen such a small piece of the puzzle that they really don't give us the whole story. And finally, we sometimes, and this is one we've wrestled with quite a bit, have to make sure the whistleblower knows what's going to happen after you write the story and they get fingered. Because the people who have committed something unethical are interested in protecting the reputation of the company, whether it deserves to be protected or not, do go after personal assaults on the character of the people who make the charges. And so those are also tough. It's easy to say, as Dan Mond did, that we have a culture where if you stand up and raise your hand, we won't shoot you down. But many companies or government agencies don't have that culture, or say they do, and in practice don't. I can't remember what number I'm up to, so I'm going to start numbering, but I want to make two more points. One is, this business of what's socially acceptable and ethical is not fixed. It changes over time. And I think that's one of the most difficult things for all of us to deal with. I'm not going to ask Dan to talk about the mortgages that one of his predecessors got from Countrywide, but I am interested in what Ben has to say about that. Because basically, we have lots of examples. That's not the only one. The examples of directors of Ford Motor Company who were clients of Goldman Sachs, who had a CEO, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs on their board, long-standing relationship between the two companies. So the CEO of Ford gets preferential access to hot IPOs, right? This in a company which has a very strong set of principles that if the purchasing agent takes money from a vendor, you know, it's the end of the world and he'll have his, you know, his little finger cut off. So somehow some things are, people do it because everybody does it. And then suddenly after the fact we decide, well, that really smells. And how to deal with that changing social mores, what's socially acceptable, what's ethical, and not to fall victim to it, to think that something's okay because everybody else does it. It's good to be the guy that says, look, every other company may bribe people, but we're not going to bribe. That's an admirable thing. But it's also true that sometimes people who get involved in these things really didn't think they were doing anything wrong because everybody did it. And how you think about how to deal with that after the fact, as Jim Johnson is discovering, is very tricky. And finally, and this is the part of the Ben's book that I like the most, is it's not about some detailed code of ethics with 14 subsections for what you do if someone tries to pick up the check for you when you went to the ball game. It does have to, in the end, come down to some deep sense of what's right and what's common sense. Because individuals who have to make these decisions are not going to consult some compendium of ethics to say whether that's right. We have an ethics code at Dow Jones. We all have to sign it. We now get it electronically, and you have to check every paragraph that you've read it, and you have to send it back. And if you don't send it back, the internal audit comes after you and say you're not going to get your check. But when the decisions that I've had to help reporters make have never been anything that's in that code of ethics. You know, we're not, those are the gross violations that are so obvious that if you do it, you're basically a crook. Foster Wyman selling information about what was going to be on the herd in the street to some stockbroker trading it. I mean, you don't need a code of ethics to know that's wrong. It's the much more difficult decisions about how you treat the people who are our sources and whether our responsibilities are more to our sources to our readers and whether you treat a 14-year-old son of a CEO who answered the phone and said something he shouldn't have said the same way you would if the CEO's PR person answered the phone. Those things basically come down to a kind of a what's right, what's common sense. You might want to consult the lawyers, and we do, but we've had very good experience with lawyers who said, I'm here to tell you that you're not going to get sued on this, and if you get sued, you'll win, but I want to tell you, are you sure this is the right thing to do, or are you being fair? And I think that's the question that has to be asked at the retail level, at the individual employee level, and that really does have to do with having some sense. I hope it comes from the culture of the organization, but frankly, I think a lot of it comes from who your parents were and what you learned in synagogue and church that leads some people to make the right decision and, unfortunately, some people sometimes to make the wrong decision. Thank you.
Maybe we'll each comment for a couple of minutes on what we've heard and then open up for questions. I just want to say that the beginning of the book is that there are forces at the core of capitalism for corruption, that you've got to make the numbers, whether it's stock price, profits, cash flow, whatever it is. They're tremendous pressures because everything's measured by numbers. The cut corners, fudge the numbers. And I think you have to have a very realistic view of capitalism and understand that if you're going to manage it, because you've got to basically constrain those pressures for corruption and then turn them into an affirmative culture. That is a very, very difficult task. But we should not be naive about what goes on, and that's why we see these endless cycles of corruption, because greed often wins out over integrity and ethics and those things. That's point one. Let me talk about very briefly about two of the most important principles in the book that respond to these comments. Number one is the consistency of the CEO, that the CEO has to be seamless in terms of living these things, not just talking about them. You clearly have to state the values and the aspirations. At GE, Jack Welch and then Jeff Immelt would look at all of you as the senior officers of the companies and say, our company's built on reputation. That reputation is built on integrity. There will be no cutting of the corners for commercial reasons. No cutting of the corners for commercial reasons. For an integrity violation, one strike and you're out. You can miss the numbers, and you might not be because it may be a bad market. But one strike and you're out. Then they have to mean it. and they've got to fire the generals, not just the troops. And this happened. I don't have time to tell war stories, but there's pretty striking stories where these guys made very tough calls on good people inside the organization, but it really crossed the line, had bent the rules. When you do that, the organization hears it, absolutely. The other thing is you've got to be consistent as a person. You can stand up in front of the big group and say ethics, blah, blah, blah. Then you go to a meeting of 40 people, a budget meeting or a strategic review. You crap on the regulators. You dump on the people who are trying to talk on an integrity issue. You behave badly. The organization hears that just as well as the speech in front of the 1,000 people. And so really, I would counsel CEOs that every meeting is a public meeting, except for the very, very, very inner circle when you do get to blow off steam and be completely irrational and wacko. But most of the time, you know, they're really public meetings, and you have to treat them that way. Okay, last point, employee voice. I think this really is something that can be protected, and you can create a culture where people are heard. People say to me, "What of all the 8 principles, what's the most important?" I would say leadership, consistency, and commitment is one. Employee voice, or the other end of the organization, is two. You have got to create, and Dan talked about this, you've got to create an organization where people are not afraid to come forward, where they know that their concerns will be treated with respect, the facts will be followed up, down, sideways, there will not be retaliation. You can create that kind of organization. There can be lots of different channels. I'm not going to go through them all. There isn't time. An ombuds system is one of them. If you look at every scandal, there is a culture of silence. People knew. They were afraid of coming forward. Culture of silence, not a culture of performance with integrity. That was what basically sunk these companies, because things went on for far too long and involved far too many. We're never going to repeal human nature. There is always going to be irreducible minimum of problems. As Dan was saying, the real trick is to catch it fast and deal with it firmly as an organization, not let it fester and be hidden. So those are a couple comments on what you both had to say.
The things I'd say on what I heard were, one, I think the point about what's the boards and what's the CEOs, there's a temptation present that I think comes logically out of government and out of bureaucracy and out of some organizations that say, if you care about something, the higher up you move it in the organization as a focus, the better off it'll be. The highest thing in the organization is the board. Give it to the board. And one policy thing that I think we're doing in the United States is giving the board so many obligations to fulfill that whether they meet 8 times a year or they meet 12 times a year, one year our board actually had over 200 meetings or committee meetings during the course of the year. There's still not enough time in the day for a board that operates on a, you know, not on a full-time basis to attend to those. So I would second that fact. I think the point about the CEO being who you are, these jobs, like anybody's busy job in this society, so strip you down to your essentials that if you try to make your essentials something other than what it is, people will see through that, and you'll ultimately, I think, fail. And the last thing I would say is this whole notion of Paul O'Neill and the close calls. It's really clear when somebody hands somebody a bag of money for giving them business that you've stepped over the line. But the way that these things actually appear, and there was a famous case we used to do at GE that said, think about the conflict that the CEO has created by two pronouncements. We are a total quality company, and we are committed to delivering on time. I mean, nobody can disagree with either of those things, right? Okay. Now what happens is a product comes down the assembly line and it's not perfect. It has a non-fatal safety, not non-safety oriented defect. It's not painted right. All right, it's not total quality, but if you stop the line to fix it, you're not going to deliver on time. What do you do? And you can write a third rule for that, and you can write a fourth rule and a fifth rule, and you can write a tenth rule for everything. But ultimately, again, it goes back to the point I think I was making before, which is at some point somebody at the right level of culture is going to have to decide where do you make the trade-offs. And those type of conflicts are where these things often emerge on a day-to-day basis, and the wrong decision immediately escalates to something humongous.
I don't have much more to add except to say that it would be nice if we all got to work for well-managed companies, but many of us don't, not speaking of my own particularly at the moment. and so the point of this book is to preach to people who run the companies at the top to make them well-managed, But I think all of us have worked in organizations which aren't well managed, which don't have clear principles, yet you still have to make these decisions. And a lot of the scandals we see come from companies which clearly had never had the conversations, like as much conversation as we've had in the last half hour with their managers or employees.
Questions? Yes.
Is this on? Yeah. There was an interesting article in today's Washington Post, and it does get to the matter of what is integrity and what do governmental entities have to do to foster integrity. The EU has decided to implement a chemicals directive, which in distinction to the United States, chemicals have to be approved in the EU before they can be used in particular products. And it's different. It's the opposite in the United States. Because there have been chemicals that have been used in products that cause cancer, among other things. What do you think of that level of regulation as a substitute for a more laissez-faire approach and letting a company have integrity and decide itself for what is safe? That's my first part of the question.
Maybe in the interest of shortage of time and other people, could we just maybe leave it at one part?
May I just say one little
sure.
thing? One of the things that's interesting to foster integrity in the EU is that the EU, any EU company that uses a chemical, will list it on a website and allow people to actually look at the product on the website and see what chemicals have been used in the product. So it kind of opens the process, lots more whistleblowers, lots more information, lots more transparency. I thought that was an interesting approach and something that doesn't have to be used, an approach that doesn't have to be used with the first part of the directive. Thank you.
Let me just answer very, very briefly. As I said in my earlier comments, there are social goods which require public law and that we can't count on all companies to do the right thing. Some companies will be free riders and get a competitive advantage because other companies will be doing it. You have to decide how important it is. Cancer-causing chemicals, and I'm not going to compare the EU with the U.S. regimes, but cancer-causing chemicals are clearly a problem. It's a social good. It ought to be regulated at some level. Now, we can disagree about that, but it's not fair to the consumer to let the free riders, you know, save costs by not doing it while some other companies do it. And I think the critical question in the CSR debate is when is it that companies should be doing things voluntarily, and when is it that we should have public law to basically set an appropriate floor where the competition comes and how well you do it and how efficiently you do it, not whether you do it at all.
I want to highlight just one thing, what you said, because I think it's an important distinction. Life and business involves taking risks. And the weighing of risks is a very difficult thing. I mean, think about the decisions that are made about whether to put a drug on the market that helps a lot of people but might have some side effects. And we do not, in our society, do a very good job of communicating risks. We are sometimes more irrationally afraid of something, the story of the guys who don't want to live next to a nuclear power plant but never wear seatbelts and smoke. I think we have to be careful to say that because someone took a reasonable risk with good judgment, not that they put a cancer-causing chemical into something, but they decided to put a drug on the market because based on the evidence they had at the time, that was the right weighing of the pluses and minuses, that if they made the wrong decision, that was prima facie evidence that they were unethical. I don't think that's right, and I think we sometimes do that.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Don Shirk. I'm at Johns Hopkins SAIS. Thank you, Mr. Heinemann, for a very stimulating session. I doubt if this kind of grouping would be held 15, 20 years ago, and therefore CSIS and Transparency International get a healthy round of applause. But let me just assume a scenario. Let me say on January 21st, the new president of the United States had just made his cabinet-level appointments, and they're all seated here in the front row. And the president has asked you to address them on their first day of work with the following statement. This is not going to be an easy job for you, gentlemen and ladies, because the United States reputation internationally is at a 50-year low point. How would you go ahead and talk to the cabinet?
I thought I was here for a private sector. private sector is tough enough. Public sector is far more complicated.
I really feel so humbled to even talk about the thing. I think it would be respect for people's point of view, greater respect than we've shown in the last 8 years, that we live in a multipolar, multicultural world, and that we need to listen to respect of people whose views may differ from ours. And I'm not talking about violence now, but different views of economic systems, political systems, cultures. And I think that we would need a process that would put all those issues on the table and try to come to more mutual solutions than we have in the past. That would be one thing I would say. But does anyone else want to be the presidential advisor today?
No, but we could have a moment of prayer. That would be
Yes. You, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Hedman. I'm Gang Xu with Warson Foster. I have a question about how do you define the role of the in-house counsel when you face with tremendous pressure from the business side to get things done and executed?
It's a really good question, and I hate to tout the book, but there is a whole chapter or section on the partner-guardian tension. I believe that the critical job, the most difficult problem for the inside staff, and I include the CFO, the HR leader, and the general counsel is being partner to the CEO, because if you're not really partnering with them, you're going to be excluded. You won't be in the conversation. And at the same time, basically being guardian of the company. And they're often in conflict. This CEO is highly rational, incredible great judgment, always has great process. But most of the time, they're high energy, want to get it done, want to make the decision fast, don't want to necessarily consider all issues. So it requires both getting the time and the ability to assess the issue properly and give the CEO options. So it requires a lot of courage and a lot of guts sometimes to do this. And the point of the book is not we shouldn't put the burden on the CFO and the general counsel and the HR leader. The CEO and the board ought to accept that this is the kind of role we want. We want people to basically raise issues that are difficult. Some will be ones where we say it's black and white and you cannot do it. Most issues are gray, very gray. And so then the question really is one of analysis for people who were sitting in my position. It wasn't that I was going to say do this or do that. I was going to say, look, we're not in the black and white area. Here are your options. You can be very gray. You can be somewhat gray, a little less gray, you know, and those all have cost consequences. But it's your decision, because I really did believe that. It was not, if it wasn't black and white, I felt it was the CEO's decision. My job was to do the analysis and give the options. But to get the time, to be able to do it, and then to be able to give a recommendation, again, goes back to the culture. The leaders have to want that. Otherwise, these jobs are very, very, very difficult. If you're a naysayer, you're excluded. If you're a yaysayer, you're not a guardian. And that's the great dilemma. And it really is, trust me, for anybody who's been inside in these positions, that is the guts of what their role is all about, finding that balance.
The comment I would make as a consumer of multiple general counsels, but a general counsel services is a general issue, is that the role of the general counsel has got two components to it. I mean, one, the component that the general counsel has that outside counsel will not have is the deep understanding of the business and therefore the ability to take the business approach and the legal, appropriate, correct, regulatory, straightforward way to do it and put those two things together. And so a general counsel that doesn't understand the business and the issues facing the business and is looked at solely as a legal expert is a big problem for an organization, or probably will create a big problem for an organization. The other thing is that in the course of that role, that becomes so important that I would say as a semi-litmus test for a general counsel, if a general counsel doesn't come into the CEO's office 6, 10, whatever number of times a year and slam the door and say, you are wrong, he or she may not be doing their job. And I had this happen to me 2 hours ago, so it's extremely it's extremely sensitive and topical for me, but I'm not gonna tell
her. Do you want to go further?
She was right, I was wrong, but don't tell her that.
just let me add one other thing. I think the going back to something that David said, I talk a lot now to young law students and other people, and I say, look, the first question you're taught to answer is it legal? But really the right question is it right? And that goes back to the fact that the role of the inside lawyer is far more than the lawyer. I mean, you're supposed to be concerned with commercial risk, with reputational risk, with ethics, all sorts of things. And so really your ultimate question you're trying to answer is it right for the institution, not is it just technically legal? And indeed, part of the history of Enron was that, first of all, the inside lawyers were excluded or gave very technical answers, and the outside lawyers gave very technical answers. Again, the point you were making about what's happened in these professions is the commercialization has led them to want to keep the clients rather than do the right thing, a topic for another time. But it's very profound. It is very profound. It's why the gatekeepers all failed in a lot of these scandals as well. It wasn't just there was a culture of silence. There was kind of this very narrow view of their role by the gatekeepers, which prevented them from asking, you know, is this right?
I just want to say one thing for the voice of experience, that I'm sure that everything that Ben said about Dan Mudd as the CEO is right, although I think you were a little hard on him. He's not a go-getter. I never know that. But basically, if you're the CEO of a company like Fannie Mae that's been through what they've been through, it's hard to like not have that that reminder when you come to work every day. And the difference between a smart editor who is, you know, was a Rhodes Scholar and has been doing it for 6 years and really can explain to you in layman's English how nuclear fusion works, and someone who may not have finished college has been around the newspaper industry for 40 years, is that you have that moment where someone, the voice, the wisdom that comes with experience, it says, you know, I just don't feel right about this. Let's not run the story tonight and take another time. And my image of the general counsel is that the best general counselors are the people who are seen as not only smart about the law, but somehow wise, in a sense that they can say something that you don't learn in law school, but you learn because you got burned six times previously with something similar in your career.
Yes.
We heard a lot about moving beyond the boards of directors to management, specifically the CEO. But the larger these organizations get, the more the ranks down to middle managers can also be involved in conflicts of interest. So my real question is, whether it be a GE having a subcommittee of middle managers deciding where the next plant might be located, and some of them might have real estate interests, or whether it be Fannie Mae managers deciding, or maybe with conflicts of interest of some of the financial firms they're dealing with, or a family member, those are the questions that are going to come up increasingly. So, and same applies with journalism and media as well. Are you asking of your employees more in terms of full disclosure and to recuse themselves when they're involved in potential conflicts of interest?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the core policies of any modern corporation, whether it's administered properly or not, is conflicts of interest. And it indeed is a disclosure question. The first issue is always you're committing to the policy to disclose any family or other interests that are in conflict with the interests of the corporation. And then the corporation has to decide, once the issue surfaces, what to do. This is pretty basic stuff, and I don't think it applies to top leaders, it tops the middle managers, it applies to people, you know, in India or Indonesia or China. So I think it's a pretty fundamental policy, and there are very fundamental ways in which these policies are administered, primarily education, especially when you're in cultures like in China, where conflicts of interest are really a way of life in terms of family relationships, and you have to spend a lot of time on education and training to say, look, we're not being critical of Chinese culture. We are a transnational culture. We are a global uniform culture. We are just going to do it differently, and then have them believe that you mean that and that they can accept that. So I think it's a very fundamental question which every company faces, if that answers your question.
Nothing to add except reflecting on the time that I was at GE. This translation was one of the big challenges at GE, because you did operate in a lot of environments that had traditional family relationships, and those family relationships were in fact also the basis of all the business relationships. And so the blend, and I got involved in a lot of these, was that typically if there were a new acquisition or a new business going into a new country, you had to create a management team that was a blend of folks that knew the local market, but also folks that could effectively import
the GE culture and, you know, interpret it for what it meant and how it could be applied and how it could be clarified at the local level, but without sort of sacrificing those global standards. And as for Fannie Mae, I mean, one of the interesting facets of our business is they're a relatively small number of people. So the answer is yes, every employee from the top to the bottom goes through those questions and is bound by the same rules that I am.
Maybe two more questions, then we'll keep to our hour. Yes, please.
Relationship between management and boards, and I've had the pleasure of sitting on a number of corporate boards, and I've reached one dilemma at one time where I thought that the CEO was so bad and the situation was so bad, but that in order to correct it, you would have, I feared, tanked the stock. The situation had gone off the rails. Now, what do you do about something like that? In other words, you have a responsibility to your shareholders from a point of view of the value of the stock, and you know that you cannot really change the whole situation except by going out to the press and doing so. Or alternatively, there are three or four alternatives: resigning.
Well, of course, I won't deal with hypotheticals, but I will. I mean, it's pretty hard in those situations. I mean, if you keep the CEO, it's only going to get worse for the shareholders. I mean, if the CEO is completely
if he's manipulating the situation such that you are a minority
on the board.
Yes.
Well, I think in those circumstances, at a minimum, you probably should resign personally. Okay. And then I think there's always the dilemma of the leak. And it's hard to know if it's just bad business judgment as opposed to unethical behavior or illegal behavior. That may be one case where you probably don't go to the press. If it's illegal behavior, can get more complicated. I mean, I really would need to know more facts. But I think resign, business probably not, legal, ethical, certainly hard question.
I mean, I would say the same thing that you know, our experience, and I think the market's experience, has been universally that, you know, bad news or stinky situations don't keep particularly well, and the longer you wait, the worse they get. So, you know, do the right thing and get it over with.
Okay, last question, sir.
I'm Glenn Ware from the Pricewaterhouse Anti-Corruption Practice Group. there's been a heightened increase in prosecutions.
Can you speak up on that?
Yeah, there's been a heightened increase in prosecutions on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and the question is that increase sufficient to drive corporate change? Do you think that they got the number right? Are they applying adequate resources so that they're going to get the return that they seek in corporate behavior, or does Mark Mendelson and crowd have to double the number, triple the number? Are corporations taking note of that, or is it still not where it needs to be?
I think the U.S. is far ahead of other industrialized nations, sadly, that under the OECD convention, which basically made foreign bribery by domestic corporations illegal, the U.S., even though it only has 10% of the OECD exports, has got more than 50% of the prosecution. So one comment would be we have to do a lot better in the U.K., which has had zero prosecutions since 1990 when the convention was ratified, Japan just had zero. And so that's certainly one issue. I think the question of you'd have to look at sort of what's their success rate. I think that corporate culture on this issue in the United States, my experience from traveling around the world and talking to other companies, and I've just come back from Germany, is better. And so I think the reality is you do need the stick, you do need the deterrence. Hopefully you can turn that into the affirmative culture that I'm talking about. But I guess I'm pretty old-fashioned. I think on some of these things, having the rule of law and having the threat can be an important part to get people headed in the right direction. I can't speak to the right number of cases and whether – I don't think you're finding too many cases with the big multinationals. My guess is that a lot of these cases are smaller companies. And just on that subject, if I might, for one second, David raised the question, well, what about the small companies? I think the reality is for small companies, because I'm asked this question every time I make this presentation or something like it, for small companies, number one, they often want to be bought. And so if you're going to be bought, when the company comes and does due diligence and they find these problems, either the price goes way down or they don't do the deal at all. And I can tell you there are a lot of circumstances where we did diligence on medium to small size companies and end up not doing the deal because what we found was not tolerable. Number two, GE, Fannie Mae can take a big hit, painful, you know, basically disconcerting, but you can take the hit and go on. Small company gets hit, they get crushed. So you run a lot of risk. And then the third question is goes back to the kind of employees you want. I really do believe, I mean, maybe everyone will look at me as a hopeless idealist, that these qualities of honesty, candor, fairness, reliability, trustworthiness are what make a company go. And if you're basically a lying, cheating company, you're not going to have those kinds of employees. And so it really does turn on the CEO, even in a small company, looking in the mirror. And I think maybe it was David who said, you know, the little dry cleaner, the local bakery or eatery, you know, they don't necessarily have that trouble because it's at a personal level. So, you know, those are the reasons I think that that small companies are should be as concerned. And I can't tell you exactly about the level of prosecution, but I think there's a lot of sensitivity in the United States to this issue.
I want to thank everybody on our panel for just a fascinating discussion today. This has been one of the really best discussions we've had at CSIS in a long time. I particularly want to thank our panel, Dan Mudd, who took a lot of time out of his busy schedule and to come here. Ben and I tried to bribe him to come here. He wouldn't accept it, and he came anyway. But this nation owes a great debt to Fannie Mae and to Dan Mudd, and we're really pleased to have him here. David Wessel, who's really one of the eminent journalists in town. He's the deputy bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. I did not try to bribe him, but I have learned that I should think twice before taking a board position at my synagogue. And also I want to thank Ben Heineman, who, as a member of our board, is just at CSIS, has really given us a lot of leadership. This book will show a lot of leadership. And I want to thank you all for coming and remind you that Olson's is selling books in the back. How's that for capitalism? Thank you for coming.